Good evening. My name is Tim Besley. I'm the director of the Suntory Toyota International Centres for Economics and Related Disciplines, more easily known as STICCRD. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you here today to the first of three STICCRD 25th anniversary lectures. STICCRD was founded in 1978, largely at the instigation of Professor Michio Morishima, who raised the endowment from Suntory and Toyota, which support STICCRD to this day. Unfortunately, Professor Morishima cannot be with us today, but I'm delighted to say that his wife, Mrs. Yoko Morishima, is in the audience. I'm sure that you will all join with me in asking her to convey to Michio our best wishes for a speedy return to health. Another important figure at the founding of STICCRD was then director Ralph, now Lord Dahrendorf. It gives me a great pleasure to welcome him back to the LSE on this occasion. I should add that we had a small ceremony prior to this lecture in which we renamed the seminar room in STICCRD the Morishima Room to recognize Michio Morishima's invaluable contributions to STICCRD and to the LSE more generally. Tonight's speaker is Sir Tony Atkinson, Warden of Nuffield College, Oxford, and a past chairman of STICCRD. Tony is one of the most distinguished economists of his generation. He's known for his many contributions to the economics of inequality and to public economics. For many years now, he's been at the forefront of academic debates on inequality and the future of the welfare state. He's been a central figure in keeping considerations of inequality central to the agenda of modern economics. Tony's contributions have been recognized in the many honors that he's been awarded. He's a fellow and past president of the Econometric Society, a fellow of the British Academy, past president of the Royal Economic Society and of the European Economics Association. He was also knighted for his services to economics. His lecture this evening is on top incomes over the 20th century. I can think of no one better qualified to talk on this subject. Tony, it's a delight to welcome you back to the LSE to give the first 25th anniversary lecture.
Thank you very much indeed. It's very, very nice indeed to be back here at the school. And I hope that the projectionist can show you now my slides, as it were. Do I have to do anything to cause this to happen? I need to go back. I'd like to start at the first slide, if I could possibly. Thank you. That's all right, I knew my... there are two more before that. Oh, well, okay. No problem. Okay. My first slide, in fact, told you what the title of my talk was, and also showed that it was referring to the STICCRD anniversary lecture, which I'd left blank because I must say I couldn't face the thought of actually putting in that it was the 25th anniversary lecture, since it reminds me that it was, in fact, 25 years ago that I joined this institution. It is, in fact, remarkable, as it were, how recent that all seems. Now, much of my time at STICCRD was spent studying the problems of people at the bottom of the income distribution. And this, of course, is a strand of work that has a very long tradition at the school, from Tawney's studies of the sweated trades and minimum wages, through the landmark study by Brian Abel Smith and Peter Townsend, The Poor and the Poorest, through to today's Centre for the Analysis of Social Exclusion. But tonight, as my title indicates, I'm going to talk about the other end of the income distribution, and this, of course, requires some justification. But as you can see from the slide with the plan of the lecture, I'm going to leave the justification, the reason for being concerned with it, to the end. There will, of course, be, even I'm talking about the top end, a lot of connections with the LSE in the course of what I'm talking about, and particularly, specifically, with the work of STICCRD. As I said, it seems amazing that 25 years has passed, but also, I think, is amazing that so much has been accomplished under the auspices of STICCRD in, which is in fact quite a short time. And I think the achievements of STICCRD are a remarkable tribute to a remarkable person, Michio Morishima, and as Tim has just said, it's been a great pleasure that we have today honoured him by naming the room after him. Now, the first section of the lecture is going to talk about what we can learn about the top of the income distribution from examining evidence from the income tax statistics. And it summarises the findings from a project which I sort of stumbled into about 3 years ago as a result of the pioneering work of Thomas Piketty, a French economist, whose study for France led me to start thinking about the same questions for the United Kingdom, and that in turn has led him with Emmanuel Saez to look at the United States, and in fact a whole group of people have started working on this subject, and I should be referring a little bit to some of the other countries along the way. But it's part of a project in which I'm drawing on the work of other people as well. Having presented what we know about the distribution of income and how it's evolved, as far as the very top is concerned, I then want to look at some of the explanations. And of course, most people would tend to think immediately about the impact of progressive income taxation, and that will be the second subject section of the lecture. But of course, in asking about the effects of taxation, we have also to ask how that taxation has impinged on other people's on people's behaviour. And the third section of the lecture will ask the question, what are the underlying economic determinants of the distribution of income at the top, or at least what are some of the underlying determinants, in order to see as well how people's behaviour may be affected by taxation, and also to see why the picture which I'm going to describe has come about. And finally, I come back to the question, why is it that I'm interested in what might otherwise seem perhaps a rather exotic or journalistic subject of incomes at the top? Now, income tax is a source not just of revenue, but also of statistics. And in fact, the development of national accounts in this country and others owed a great deal to records available from income tax. But in the last 20 or 30 years, perhaps, use of this source has rather died out. And in fact, it's rather become scorned by many economists. For example, the index to Oscar Morgenstern's book on the accuracy of economic observations contains the entry, income tax, comma, as reason for lying. And that, I think, summarizes quite well the general skepticism people have. As so if you say to them you're using data from the income tax, they think, obviously, of the fact that people evade taxes, people avoid taxes, people make complicated financial transactions to prevent their income being taxed, and as a result, it's very hard, obviously, to establish anything approaching reality. And of course, the information you get is coloured by the fact that it was derived for the purposes of collecting income tax, so the definitions of income, the definitions of the income unit, and so on, all reflect the tax system. And I should also say there's very little in the way of contextual information, very little in order to see who these people are that I'm going to be talking about in the top one or smaller percentage of the population. At the same time, one has, of course, to bear in mind that alternative sources, particularly if you're interested in looking at the top of a distribution, also suffer from serious shortcomings. They suffer from the fact that people don't necessarily report parts of their income, people don't necessarily give you all the detail of their investments, and of course, if you're sufficiently rich, you may well not take part in the kind of surveys of households which we tend to use in other sources. After all, it takes quite a long time to fill in your tax return. It's all right, you've still got 11 days, I think, if you haven't yet done yours for this year. But nonetheless, it is a time-consuming business, and it's not surprising, therefore, that some of the people I want to look at, people who are extremely wealthy, when faced with filling in a questionnaire for the British Household Panel Survey or the Labour Force Survey, simply refuse to take part. And so, although the tax data clearly have their deficiencies, and I'll be talking about those in a moment, then nonetheless, they provide a source of information which is complementary, I think, with other sources. And they have a role particularly in covering the periods of time, particularly over the last century, the beginning of the last century, for which we have no other sources. And as you can see, we'll see in a moment, the series I'm going to present goes back, in fact, to 1908, and by the standards of economics, a time series that goes on for nearly a century is certainly quite lengthy. Now, you may in fact wonder, if you know the history of income tax in this country, why I don't go back to the beginning, to William Pitt's income tax of 1801. And indeed, there were some statistics produced for that income tax. But the reason I don't go back is an interesting little sidelight on political economy, because when the income tax was first introduced, it was naturally unpopular, and in particular, one of the themes on which people seized was the fact they didn't like the idea that some clerk in a government office would actually know what the total income was of these people paying the income tax. And as a result, when the tax was reintroduced in 1804, when the Napoleonic Wars were recommenced, the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time bowed to these objections, and the tax was changed to become one where it was a tax on your income from different sources being taxed separately. It was a scheduled tax where your income from one farm will be taxed by one clerk, your income from another farm by another, and no one in fact would ever add up and discover what your total income was. And it's only in fact with the arrival of super tax in 1908, the famous budget which the House of Lords threatened to throw out and led to the constitutional renegotiation at that time, the super tax that Lloyd George brought in was the first time that actually people's total income was made available to the tax authorities. And that's the information I'm going to use. Now, the most obvious problem with this sort of information is that I'm talking, as you'll see in a moment, about a very small group of people. I turned this thing the wrong way around. Yes, right. That gives you the structure of this section. I'm talking about a relatively small group of people, I'm talking about information of the kind which I described at the top of this slide. And obviously, to make sense of it, one has to relate this to the population as a whole. That is, the taxpayers were the very small fraction of the population. We want to look at them as a group relative to the total population, so we need a control total for total population. Equally, we want to know what fraction of total income this group received. We can't just look at the people covered by the tax statistics. We have to relate it to, again, a control total for the income in the country. And quite a lot of the work that lies behind the figures that I'm going to cite is based on using information from national accounts and other sources, particularly the work of Charles Feinstein, to arrive at a total. So when we talk about the top 1% having X percent of total income, we know where that total income comes from. It's something which is related to the national accounts. And finally, we need, since I'm using here information drawn from tabulations, that is from tables published, all of this information is in the public domain. It's all in the reports of the Inland Revenue or reports to Parliament over the years. It's not using micro data drawn from surveys except in the most recent years. All this information is in that rather simple form of incomes in different ranges, and therefore we need to interpolate between those ranges. And here I've drawn particularly on the work of Frank Cowell and his group who are working on these subjects in Stickert today. So that is what I'm using. I'm using information from the income tax to see what the distribution looks like for, as I said at the beginning, a very small group of people. When super tax began, it was paid by people with incomes of 5,000 a year or more. 5,000 pounds in 1908 was something like 60 or 70 times the average income. So you can work out, if the average income today is 15, 20,000, we're talking about people who are certainly with incomes of well over a million in equivalent terms. And very few people were in that group. The first group was 11,000 people, and they were 0.05% of the population. 0.05, that is 1/20th of 1%. Now, you're used to seeing statistics on things like the top 10% or the top 1%. I'm talking about a group which is 1/20th of the top 1%. And to give some idea who they were, the salary at that time of High Court judges was £5,000 a year, as incidentally was the salary of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I'm not quite sure what would happen today if the Chancellor got up and announced a new tax that began at just the income which he, Chancellor, happened to be drawing at that time. So the Chancellor and above are the people that I'm talking about. A very small group, but a group which received a quite substantial fraction of total income. And if I hold this now the right way around, this graph shows the results of the work I've just been describing. It shows the shares of the total income that people receive accruing to these very small groups, the top 0.05%. But you can see this is 8%, getting on for 10%, getting on for a tenth, a twelfth of total income, which this very small group of people who are basically the top 10, 12,000 people in the country. This is in 1908, and as you can see, the story then evolves over the course of the century. The Chancellor, in fact, fairly soon, became liable to super tax because the threshold was reduced, and at that point we then began to have information on the top 0.1%. But from this you can see some of the things, some of the sort of history, as it were, of what has happened at the very top of the distribution. You can see, for example, the effects of wars. I've marked the First World War and the Second World War. I found it's necessary nowadays to explain. Someone once asked me, am I giving this lecture, why is it called the Second World War? And I had to explain there had been a First World War as well. This is the First World War, 1914, 1918. This is 1939, 1945. You can see in both of those a quite substantial reduction in the share, and that's perhaps part of the story that we'll need to be exploring. But you can also see that it wasn't just in wartime that these shares began to fall. And I'm going to talk for the moment on the period of fall, which you can see extends for three quarters of this century. Now, first of all, the interwar period. One virtue of these data is that you can actually say something about the interwar period. It's interesting, there's no other data that I know of that tells you anything about the income distribution. Peter Lindert, in his survey of income distribution in Britain and America, simply jumps from 1911 to 1938 like that. But you can see that the annual data do tell us something. It tells us there was a clear downward movement, but it was not a steady trend. It was periods of decline, particularly the effects of the Wall Street, the London and Wall Street crash in 1929, 1930, but then a period of stability, and then again some movement down. And that is, I think, the way in which we should characterize what has been going on. That is, it's neither simply a few events like wars, nor is it a steady downward trend that we're observing for any of these groups. The same is true for the 1950s. There was quite a strong movement, both after the Second World War, up until the mid-1950s. So, for example, now looking at somewhat bigger groups, the top 1%, their share of total income fell from more or less halved between 1937 and 1957. And to put this information in just a slightly different form, if we take the top 0.1%, the top thousandth of the population, to be in that group at the beginning of my story, you had to have about 40 times average income. After the war, 30 times was enough. After this war, 20 times was enough. So the qualification to be in the top group was steadily falling. And you can see it went on falling, although with periods of stability. A period in the late 1950s, early 60s of stability. And you can see again then fairly rapid decline in the 60s, a period of the Conservative government, I think, of stability there, and then in the 1970s. And by the time you get down to here, to be in that top 1%, you only need 8 times average income. So the entry ticket had been steadily falling over this period. And of course, in talking about these groups, I'm not suggesting they're the same people necessarily. There's a fair amount of movement clearly would have been going on over this time. But the basic story of the first three quarters of the century was of a very, very substantial reduction in the share of income going to the very top of the income distribution, a very substantial reduction. You can see the top 1% goes from 20% down to something like 6%. That is major distributional change. much more change than you'll find, I think, lower down the distribution. Then, of course, things changed. This
here is pounding a sticker.
As a minor piece of news in the back pages, Mrs. Thatcher was elected Prime Minister. And you can see things have changed dramatically since then. In interpreting this, we have to take account of the fact that up until this point, I've been talking about husbands and wives as tax units, because that's how they were taxed. And then one thing happened under the Conservatives was we introduced independent taxation, and that creates a slight hiatus in the statistics. It also causes problems in comparing across different countries, some of which have taxed people, some of which tax families. But leaving that aside, you can see that there was then a remarkable change in the evolution of these shares. Between 1978 and 1989, the share of the top 1% rose by 3 percentage points. That's 3 percentage points starting off at 6, so it's going from 6 to 9. It rose by a further 3 percentage points beyond 1990. And
those of you who want to give a political explanation, you can see these are the last 3 years. 99 is left out from there, but 2000, 98, and 97. So
even though the present Chancellor was very critical of some of the tax changes that lay behind the earlier increases, it still seems to have been going on under the current Labour government. And indeed, by the end of the period, the figures there, you can see reading back, we've gone in some sense back to 1949, immediately after the war. Those shares more or less got back to that. All of this relates to incomes, I should say, before tax. We can't go back for incomes after tax so far, but the next slide shows how far we can go back. And you can see going back to 1937, these are the shares. The shares are smaller because this is now after allowing for the progressive income taxation. So these are after you've paid your income and other and higher rates of tax. You can see, amongst other things, the effect of the 1988 budget that took place. Then that's when the top tax rates were cut very substantially. That was the time when one Conservative MP said he hadn't enough noughts on his calculator to work out his reduction in taxation as a result of the budget. So you can see that showing up in there, but of course also there are the underlying changes in gross incomes as well. Now what we're observing here are changes that affect, there are sometimes two kinds of changes going on. One is the distribution between what we might call the rich and the poor, that is between this group as a whole and the rest of the population. The other is the distribution within the rich. And to look at that, I want to take now what I'll call the shares within shares. By which I mean that if you take, say, the top 10%, and just take one of the years when it was quite low, the share of the top 10% was about 25% in gross income. Not net income, in gross income. Now within the top 10%, we tend to think of them as a homogeneous group, they're all well off as it were. But within the top 10%, there's also a lot of inequality. In fact, if you take the top 10% within the top 10%, if you take the top 1%, who are the top tenth, as it were, of the top 10%, then they have about 22% of the total income of that group. And if you take the top tenth within the top 1%, that is the top 0.1%, they also have about 22% of total income. It's a bit like one of these sort of Russian dolls. You start to, as you unpack it, you take out one, look inside it, and you discover there's as much inequality relatively within it as there was before you started, and then you do it again, and so on. And that reflects the fact that the upper tail of the distribution has approximately the form described by Pareto many years ago, where the proportion of the population above a specified income level is proportional to that level of income to minus some power, and that power is the Pareto coefficient. And the Pareto coefficient is then a summary, if you like, of the degree of concentration at the top. It doesn't apply throughout the distribution, but it summarizes the inequality within the distribution at the very top. And That is related to, using the formula I just put on the bottom of this slide, related to the shares within shares, that is the share of the top one within the top ten. It shows you the relative inequality within the rich, not the inequality between the rich and the poor. It separates out these different elements. And you can see again the same pattern, that this not just a question of redistribution away from the rich to the poor over the first part, and a higher coefficient means essentially less inequality for the same total income. You see the same pattern happening within the distribution as well as between the rich and the poor. And I mention this partly because this Pareto coefficient provides a link to some of the explanations that I want to talk to you about in a moment. Now, this all relates to Britain. I'd like to just look very briefly now at some other countries, because that, I think, also puts this in perspective. I've shown here the results of Thomas Piketty for France. He was very interested to know how France compared with the UK. He didn't do the UK, he was interested when I started doing it. And in fact, if you look at France, France is the dashed line. It's sort of about here. It's very similar, in fact, to the UK, which in itself is rather remarkable, because in 1913, we weren't, well, not much more than 100 plus years since the French Revolution, a country that had been through major social change, whereas Britain, as it were, had not had that degree of social change, and yet it appeared that this particular indicator of social concentration of social resources was not very different in the two countries. And in fact, you can see that the same is true also for the United States. Again, rather surprising. The United States has a much shorter history in terms of accumulation of property and so on. And it was true of the Netherlands, which are the four countries I've shown in here. And this was true, not just at the beginning, but also they moved, with some differences in the time pattern, down in very similar extent over the course of this period. So we see not just reduction in inequality, but also a very similar direction of movement in these four countries. Up until the fateful date here, where you can see then there's a divergence. That is, this is the United States, this line going up here. That's the celebrated rise in inequality in the United States. This is the United Kingdom, going up in a rather similar degree. This one is France, consistently flat. And this is the Netherlands, if anything, falling. And the same similar thing is shown on the next one, which gives you also Canada.
It shows convergence of the structure of the distribution up to that point, and then divergence. Anglo-Saxon countries heading off, in this case, is greater inequality. It's a measure of the degree of concentration getting greater as you come down here. France and particularly the Netherlands going off in a different way.
So continental Europe, and it is continental Europe. The same picture does not appear in the case of Scandinavia. Continental Europe seems to be behaving very differently. Now, what is that going to be due to? Clearly, clearly taxation has quite a lot to do with it. In fact, we have to bear in mind, and it's often forgotten, that Britain over this period has had very substantial tax rates. I meant to put this slide in because people tend to think that high tax rates over 50 up to nearly 98, 100, are a thing of the fairly recent past. They think it was Dennis Healey, or perhaps with long memories, I think it was Stafford Cripps. But in fact, it was long before even any Labour government that we had tax rates of 50%. This goes back to immediately after the First World War. So we had a very long period over this century of very high rates of taxation. And it therefore certainly suggests that what has been going on is, as this graph perhaps provides some support, that the U-shaped movement of inequality, this big reduction followed by the reversal, was due to the high progressive rates of taxation. Shown over here, the other way round, that is,
It's 1 minus the tax rate, so it's what's left to you after taxation. And as that went down, so the shares went down. And it shows the cumulative effect of past taxes because it takes it over a 25-year period. Now, that graph is perhaps it's suggestive, however, shouldn't be taken perhaps too seriously. I mean, it looks as though it provides an attractive fit. But, of course, there are grounds for being sceptical. The first ground is these taxes certainly have led people to do things which mean they aren't being taxed. It would have led to tax avoidance and tax evasion. So it may be that all we're actually capturing is purely a statistical artifact, purely the fact that the observed incomes reflect the high rates of tax because people don't wish to be taxed under income tax and avoid them. Or, of course, it's also possible that the high taxes have affected people's behaviour. And, of course, the effects of taxation were one of the principal subjects of the research programme which, when I was here in Stickard, together with Mervyn King and Nick Stern, we had a programme of research precisely on the incidence of taxation and its distributional effect. Now, is it then the case that the rearrangement of income, rather than any genuine change in income, is what has been going on? And of course, there was a very powerful argument to this effect in the book Income Distribution and Social Change, written by Richard Titmuss in this institution 40-odd years ago, in which he argued that essentially was what was going on. Other people, and the Inland Revenue amongst them, were concerned that in fact what was happening was that investors were moving their money into forms, particularly company shares, which generated little in the way of taxable income, low dividends, but high capital growth. And it's certainly true over this period that in the period from the Second World War, the period of some of the biggest decline here, was also a time when we saw companies retaining much more in the way of profits. Profits were being kept in companies and were generating capital gains, whereas before the Second World War there had not been substantial amounts in that form. They then became much more important. And in the paper which I'm drawing on here, I therefore asked the question, if we took that money, which in some sense might be thought to be missing from these figures, and added it back in, would it mean that these shares would not have fallen to the extent that they did? And the answer is, it would make a difference, but not enough to destroy the basic pattern. So I think that there is a genuine phenomenon here to explain. And how can we then explain it? If we then look at where income comes from, this provides a rather good starting point. That is, in thinking about what the causes of this concentration are, we have, I think, to separate out between, on the one hand, earned income, and on the other hand, investment income. The kinds of explanations for these two are obviously rather different. And one can think about the shares I've been talking about, and here I've taken the top 1%, as being broken or decomposed into an element due to earnings, which I'm going to talk about, and an element due to investment income, which I'm going to leave on one side. And it's going to depend on the mix of these two, and it's going to depend on the distribution of these two, and it's going to depend on who these people are. That is, the third of the elements, the alignment coefficient, depends on whether the top 1% of all incomes are mostly people with earned income or mostly people with investment income. That is, if you look behind these figures and ask, are they people with large salaries? Are they people with large amounts of money invested in shares? That's going to be important because, as we can see in a moment, moving on the next slide, that the shares of these different sorts of income have clearly changed a lot over the century. This is related to, but not the same as, the shares of wages and profits in national income. This is the share of investment income in total personal income. And it's not the same as the share of capital in national income for two reasons. One is that it refers to income and not to national product. And so income from abroad, for example, and that's where the wars were certainly important. Income from abroad, capital income on investments held overseas, that certainly led to a reduction in the share of investment income, you can see here in the case of the Second World War and also in the First World War, the loss of assets that were used at that time and not recovered afterwards. That's one element of the story, that is the difference between national income and national product. But also it differs from it because the income of going to capital, of course, goes to not just to people, but also to institutions. And institutions have grown in significance over this time. Pension funds, life assurance companies, are all drawing investment income as well. And so these two things are not the same. But you can see there's been quite a major shift in these sources over this time. And that matters because when you look at the sources individually, you look at the inequality within the sources. And I've taken here wealth rather than capital income, but it's the same, basically, the source of investment income. You can see that this, measured on this scale, gives you the share in capital income of the top 1%. And look at the numbers here. They're 10 times the numbers on the scale over here, which is the scale of the earned income. Investment income is much more unequal. The share of the top 1% in investment income is 20, 30, 40, 50, 60%. The share of earnings is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So any shift away from investment income towards earned income is in itself going to reduce inequality. But the element I want to focus on is earned income. And these figures here are, I should say, completely new in the sense that this series refers to the New Earnings Survey, and that's fairly well, obviously very well known, but although people haven't tended to look at the top 1%, which is what I've done here. But the part before it is drawing on again on the income tax data, and this shows that for earnings, taking only earned income now, we have the same U-shaped pattern that I described for the whole of incomes earlier. So the phenomenon we need to explain is not just a phenomenon of total income, it also applies to the earnings part. Explanations for that are necessary on their own. And what are the possible explanations that I want to look at? I'm going to look at two of these. The first of them is one based on executive remuneration. This is essentially an idea due originally to Herbert Simon and one to other people from the 1950s, which was that in a hierarchical organization, of course the LSE is not, but any organization which has a strict sort of pyramidal form, which of course may not be true today, and that's one of the parts of the story, where you have a span of control of managers. So a manager has a certain number of people for whom they're responsible, and a certain increment in the salary as you go up the scale. Then, as Simon showed, in that case, the Pareto coefficients, the coefficient I use to measure inequality, can be directly related to, and this is one of the reasons I used it to make this direct connection, to the increments required for promotion relative to the span of control. And so if we're asking why it is we've seen changes, for example, why we've seen an increase in inequality in earnings in recent years, that may be because of changes in the increments required for promotion, which may be associated with the opening up of markets, for example, for managers. And we tend to talk about the impact of globalization, although it's a matter for steel workers, for call centers, or other workers that were in the middle or bottom of the distribution. But I suspect that the implications in the labor market are much bigger for people at the top of the distribution, and that the increased mobility of managers is one reason which has led to essentially an expansion of the increments associated with moving up hierarchical organizations. And that can also, I suppose, be put as one reason why continental Europe has not seen the same degree of movement, because the language and other barriers to mobility are greater than they are within the Anglo-Saxon countries, where the increase in inequality has been particularly marked. There are, of course, well-known counterexamples, like the chief executive of BT, or Monsieur Garnier of GlaxoSmithKline. They were drawing on the Netherlands and France, respectively, but in general, the market for managers is probably less global in the case of non-Anglo-Saxon countries. Now, those two gentlemen may be more keen to associate themselves with the second explanation that I want to look at, which is the superstar theory of Sherwin Rosen and Robert Frank. And this is the idea that the expansion of scale, again associated with globalization and with technical change, has allowed people who are at the top of their respective professions to raise the rents which they're able to extract by virtue of being at the top of the scale. As it was put in the title of the book by Frank and Cook, it was the winner-take-all society, or in statistical terms, it's an extreme value distribution. And it's certainly plausible to suppose that where technical change, where communication possibilities have expanded the market in this way, this has allowed the earnings gradient to become steeper. And Robert Frank, for example, argues that it's fair to say that virtually all top decile earners in the United States are participants in labor markets in which rewards depend heavily on relative performance. And this could perhaps explain then the decline, the rise in the inequality at the very top. And indeed, Sherwin Rosen made precisely that prediction in 1981 when he referred back to Alfred Marshall's principles. And Marshall said the development of new facilities for communication by which men who have once attained a commanding position are enabled to supply their constructive or speculative genius to undertakings vaster and extending over a wider area than ever before. He must, I think, have had some vision of what was going to happen in Seattle 100 years later. Now, the superstar theory is, I think, potentially very interesting, but of course it has to be looked at in an international context. That is, one can't think about this purely in one country. Clearly the changes that affect distribution in, say, the United States are going to have implications for other countries. We don't have parallel universes. And in this respect, we can contrast the two explanations that I've been looking at. That is, if it is a question of the market for managers, we would expect an increase in the demand in the United States to pull up with it the salaries in other countries, United Kingdom and other European countries. On the other hand, if it's a superstar explanation, it may be that the reverse is at work. That is, that the one consequence of the effectively greater reach of, say, American superstars is that it reduces the rents which can be earned by those in other countries. So, for example, if Manchester United is able, through communication of its games, through the sales of its t-shirts and so on, to extend the rents it can extract, that may be at the expense not just of Colchester United, but also of Paris Saint-Germain. And so there will be international interactions between these, and that may then be one reason why we're observing different movements in different countries. Because that is part of the puzzle, the intellectual puzzle that I think this information presents, of explaining the change over time within a country, this remarkable reversal which the Anglo-Saxon countries have seen, and explaining the differences across major OECD countries in what we've seen. Now, why do I think these questions are of more than simply were intellectually puzzles? Why the fuss? And this is a quotation, not, I should hasten to say, from the early work of the Shadow Chancellor, as you'll see down here, it is indeed his father, who was a very distinguished member of this institution, one of my colleagues when I was here. This is from Bill Letwin, who's asking at, and the date is very relevant, is asking basically this at around about the crucial date of beginning of Stickard. It was around then he was asking, what is the reason? Surely what we're talking about is, as he says, these are obviously exceptions, these extremes, and why, basically, should we look at them other than as exotic creatures for curiosity rather than serious study? Well, there's, I think, three reasons I'll give you very quickly why I think these are potentially important. The first reason is that actually they do have quite a large amount of income, and it does make a significant difference to the distribution of income. And you can see, I mean, this may seem rather strange to say this, because if you imagine looking at the whole distribution, for example, drawing a Lorentz curve, which shows the fractions of population and the fractions of total income, then the top 0.1% is really when you get right to the end. I mean, it's, you could imagine drawing a diagram like this. I mean, they're really right down here. They're very, they're the last little millimetre, as it were, of the diagram. But they do have a substantial fraction of total income, as we've seen. And one can see that the effect on overall inequality, for example, measured by the most popular measure, the Gini coefficient of inequality, you can see from that that the shares do have a material impact. Broadly, if, say, the shares in the United States, say, shares of the top 1% rise by 10 percentage points, then broadly the Gini coefficient would rise by 6 percentage points. And that is not unlike what's actually been observed in the United States. And I think that the effects at the top have been one of the things driving what has been happening in the overall rise in inequality. That is, the Gini coefficient with these triangles shows you that's the rise in inequality here. That's what has made Paul Krugman, other people in the United States, all very concerned about rising income inequality. Clearly, the top 1% are only part of that story, but they are, I think, part of that story, as you can see in these pictures. The second reason for concern was very well brought out in a lecture at this institution, possibly in this room, by Brian Barry a few years ago, in which he argued that there are two forms of social exclusion. That is, in addition to what we normally look at in terms of social exclusion, in addition to what I think is the main concerns of the Center for Analysis of Social Exclusion, in addition to the word exclusion at the bottom, there is exclusion at the top, or what he referred to as elite separation, in which the well-off can choose to insulate themselves, to quote from him, from the common fate and buy their way out of the common institutions. And this voluntary isolation takes the concrete form of the private purchases of education, private schools, private childcare. It takes the form of private healthcare, and in an extreme form, it takes the form of gated communities. And this ability to use exit as a strategy clearly depends on the distribution of income. And a very simple way of thinking about it is that almost all of these activities involve labour. That is, they're mostly services, essentially health services, education are heavily labour intensive. Clearly the police, the private security and the gated community are labour. And so it's useful to think about income in terms of how much labour, as it were, that you can purchase with it. And that's why, as a rather simple-minded index of this, I looked at the number of people whose incomes were sufficient to buy at least, as it were, 10 people. And 10 is obviously an arbitrary number, and you could choose any number. It gives you an indication, as it were, of how many people you could actually employ out of your income. And at the beginning of the century, it was running around about 100,000 or so. For some reason, it went up, I don't quite know why. Perhaps wages fell at that time. And then as you can see, went steadily down. So towards 1978 watershed, it was down about 120,000 people. But we have seen since then a rise in this number again. We're now again back to more or less immediate post-war levels. So that, I think, again, is a reason why the distribution of income may well impinge on the nature of our societies, in the sense that it gives people the increased income is in fact significant, in that it allows people to opt out in this way by purchasing services that the rest of us, as it were, would buy collectively through state and other communal provision. And then the last concern is a global one. And so far I've been talking about the national position, and one may wonder what is the significance of all this on a global scale. And the top 1% in the United States is something like 1.3 million tax units. The world population is whatever, 6 billion or so. So this is a very small group, and does it matter? To have a look at this, I looked that's the estimates that have been done by François Bourguignon and Christian Morisson of the world distribution of income. And they use for this purpose evidence about national distributions, and then they combined it by using information about incomes per head, adjusted for purchasing power differences. And I won't go into the problems, which are many, with that kind of approach. And I took their calculations and then asked myself the question, now, where, as it were, on a world distribution of income, would these people fit? And for that purpose, again, I took an arbitrary definition. I took those people as being globally, as it were, in inverted commas, rich, if they had more than 20 times the average income in the world, which, just to give you a feel, in 1992, which is the most recent data they had, it was $100,000. And in 1992, there were something like 7 million people in the world with incomes above this, most of them, but not a majority in the United States, and they constituted 0.14% of the world population, with a total world income, total income of 5.4% of the total world income, rather more than the total income of Germany. Now, those are simply arbitrary in terms of choosing that criterion, but I think what is of interest is how it's changed. And this is the last of the slides I'm going to show you. This shows you the globally rich as it's changed since the beginning of the 20th century. As we would expect, this has been falling because the world has been getting richer over this time, and we've seen there's been a reduction in inequality in the rich countries. In the United Kingdom, certainly has been falling. They've been falling as a fraction of the world's population. In the United States, they rose initially and then fell. But again, we see the reversal. But despite the fact, as it were, the world is getting richer in terms of countries developing and so on, all the East Asian and other countries becoming richer, despite that, the American, now they're globally rich, are able now to become an increasing fraction of the population. And these last two here show the effect of the changes that have been since 1992. That is, in 8 years, the numbers have increased by this much, which is quite a big change in this period. And so I think that the changes in this group do have implications in terms of the role of a group of people who, as it were, have serious amounts of money on a world scale, and this in turn has implications for ideas about some form of global taxation, that is, ideas of looking at issues about taxation not purely on a national basis, but having possibly some kind of super tax for those at the very top of the distribution on a global basis. Would, I think, this is why I think these things are possibly worth discussing. But that's a subject for another lecture. What I want to summarize by saying is that may have been true a quarter of a century ago that top incomes were disappearing. They could be dismissed as quantitatively unimportant. But I think the picture has changed because of what's happened in the last 20, 25 years for a variety of reasons which I can't claim that I fully understand. And I think for this reason, this remains not just, as it were, an intellectual puzzle to try and explain what has been happening to the distribution, but also an issue which has public policy implications. And perhaps to end with the reason which Tawney gave for looking at this problem in a lecture he gave here many years ago, he referred to the fact that what thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people call the problem of riches. Thank you very much.
Tony has kindly agreed to take a few questions. We have about 5 minutes or so if some of you have questions. Tony, do you want to come back to the lecture?
Have a drink of water first.
Yeah. Let Tony have a drink of water while you're thinking of questions. There are roving microphones. Could I ask you to wait until one of them arrives if you wish to ask a question? So if anyone has a question at this point, could they raise their hand? So go over there. We'll Are you sufficiently
yes,
covered with water to...
Yep, sure.
I was reading, I think it was in the FT about 4 or 5 months ago, there was a, I think it was on the front page actually, it sort of said that, I think they said something like about 30% or maybe 20% of people in the city were on over £100,000 a year. And if you look at the new earnings survey, I think apart from CEOs, the top paid people are basically finance managers, earning more than all the other professions. Do you think that may, the fact that this, they're in basically finance, may have an impact upon, as it were, the people that are actually handling the capital may actually influence why you've got this income inequality?
That's an interesting question, but I hadn't made that particular connection between... I think you're right in saying certainly, professors of finance, I think, earn more than other professors. I think there are certain examples where I agree that's true. But I think that this is a much wider group than simply directors of finance. I think, this is certainly, clearly CEOs are, in a sense, have much wider responsibilities than those simply financial. On the other hand, it's my own feeling that much of these things are, one ingredient in explaining this is the expectations, the social norms that people bring to bear when discussing remuneration, and I'm sure that these are influenced partly by the financial structures and the financial groups which we're talking. And of course, I gather that the sociology, as it were, of executive, particularly of the city, is currently a rather rapidly developing, very interesting subject, which I'm looking forward to hearing more about. It's an interesting thought.
We have another question over there.
In relation to what you've just said, is these big handouts to get in this modern day and age, do you think is it just from an economic point of view? I mean, it all happens in the city anyway, I suppose.
Yes, I'm not sure the city is the only source location of this, and I think that I think, again, we've seen it in the academic world, and we've seen while academic salaries clearly have not on the whole risen, we've seen a much bigger dispersion. I mean, that incidentally is another aspect of this research project I'm looking at the moment, is you can now look at universities and they now have to publish distribution of salaries above 50,000, and it's actually quite interesting to look at that and see how that's changed. I don't think it's purely right to say that it's a problem, a question of the city.
Is not the American enthusiasm for performance-related systems, doesn't that affect a much wider proportion of the population now?
Yes, although in fact, at least one member of the audience knows more about this than I do. My understanding is that my colleague John Goldthorpe has found it quite difficult actually to demonstrate that in the British data, that in fact, rather surprisingly, performance-related pay doesn't show up as having increased quite as much as one thinks. I suspect what's happened is it's changed its location to some degree. So we've seen disappearance of performance-related pay, say, in manufacturing, partly because manufacturing's declined, and an increase clearly in areas where it wasn't known at all before, like the public sector, for example. Yes, I think you're right, and indeed, in another lecture I gave some time ago, I did actually argue that what we've seen is we've probably seen a switch from a system where there was a more egalitarian approach to pay, where there's much more averaging, as it were, across people's contribution to productivity, that one could imagine, as it were, one situation where that was consistent with firms maximizing profits and workers responding to incentives, to another equilibrium where we pay is much more closely tied to the individual contribution. And those, as it were, that's certainly, I think, one explanation for why one could see, for example, in certain countries, a shift of this kind. In the case of the United States, for example, I know Larry Summers referred to the shift to paying essentially everyone like salesmen rather than on some
on professional scales and other scales, that maybe why certain countries have seen that shift, and other countries like Scandinavia, perhaps with a relatively less dispersed distribution of productive capacities, have not seen that shift. So I think I find that quite an attractive avenue to go down, yes. Okay.
One more question.
What do you think about the correlation between the trends in income inequality and the trends of the topic income inequality, for example, on the mass media? Because, for example, I remember there was Paul Krugman in some of his New York Times articles says that, for example, in the States now, there's people were able to shift the emphasis from like economic elitism to cultural elitism. And this is an example of a positive correlation. So what's your opinion about this correlation?
Ah, yes. Well, certainly Paul Krugman writing was a direct result of these researches. So he's quoting basically this research in his, well, the one New York Times article that I've seen. Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's, for example, always struck me as evidence in some sense of the political nature of this, that most of the attention has tended to focus on the lower part of the distribution, the idea that what we've observed is the de-skilling workers that we've seen as a shift in, as we're against unskilled workers. But of course, if you look at the United States, that shift, although it took place in the early 80s, has now been largely removed, I mean, gone back. I mean, there's been virtually no continual downward trend in the position of the, say, bottom people at the bottom decile. All of the action in the last period, I mean, the last 15, 20 years, has been at the top. The bottom part has contributed actually to reducing inequality. And yet all attention continues to be on what's happening in terms of skill levels of unskilled workers and so on, whereas it's not directed at what I think has quantitatively been much more important, which is what's happened in the top 10% and upwards. And that, of course, is a reflection partly of a sort of, there are clearly interests in keeping that discussion where it is.
Okay, it just remains for me to thank Tony for an excellent lecture, and I think it embodies in many ways the values of Stickard has, and when it was set up by Michio Morishima, to do economics with real relevance to issues that arise in the world. And I think Tony has demonstrated that when he was chairman of Stickard and demonstrated in his lecture this evening. So I hope you'll join me in thanking him for the wonderful presentation. Thank you very much, Tony.